It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you all along. Good to see my partner.
Always good to see you, Sean.
Captain Mike Ward. We had a good conversation. We're already kind of turning the corner here. The last day of deer season today, but I called you this week. I think the first thing out of my mouth was, ready to go do some deep dropping?
Ready
to go do some way offshore fishing?
I'm ready to just put my boat in the water.
That's right. Do a little bit of that. If we can catch some good weather days, we can go get after that. Of course, it's not over on the hunting front for sure. And even here before turkey season, we've got the month of February into March, and you got a lot of small game options out there. So there's still plenty of hunting to be done.
A lot of rabbit hunters.
Yeah.
State's got plenty of rabbits. Some quail hunters.
Mm-hmm. Eight or nine of us. Yeah.
There's a few of you left. There's plenty of stuff to do.
And the squirrels, yeah, we can get into that. But we're going to talk about the bird portion of it today, and it's a real treat to get Stephen Mitchell, who's been on with us in the past, talking about upland birds with the state of Alabama. He's supervising district biologists in the state, and the person who is now in charge of all the upland birds in the state of Alabama, Brandon Earls, both joining us on today's show. Thanks for being here, y'all.
Thank you for having us.
Brandon, is that a lot of pressure on you, that you're responsible for all the upland birds in the state?
It's going to be a transition.
So, y'all, this is Brandon, talk about your history here before taking this position.
So, I graduated Auburn in 2015, and I was part of the statewide turkey project in 2015-16, and then I went to USDA Wildlife Services, where I spent about 5 years, and then 2 years ago, I came over to the state.
And now it's quail, it's turkeys. What else falls under? Is that the
species? And then we have grouse.
Yeah. Then
do
we
have grouse?
Two rough grouse up on the Tennessee and Georgia line.
Is it too? Yeah, that's the funny thing. Yeah, and people will look through the if you look through your booklet or whatever from the state, and it talks about prohibited species and rough grouse. Rough grouse having a tough time, you know, way up, you know, further up into Virginia and Pennsylvania, but here in Alabama, they've been having a rough time for a long time. I didn't even know we do have some left. Y'all have confirmed that?
It's not been lately, but a few years ago we did have a few up in Jackson County.
Were those and I don't know the long history of that. Was there a time when we had a robust population, or a population that would meet, you know, what you'd think would be a decent population, or has it always been this kind of small population?
For a long time, it's been a very small population, and, you know, it's usually contained up in North Alabama. And so that habitat is lacking, just like, our quail habitat for the most part.
And looking like it, and I know we'll get back to other stuff, and Mike's going to go Sean and his rough grouse, but up in the Northeast, we'll be up in Pennsylvania, and they will, people up there will complain to me, well, we're not logging enough, we're not getting, you know, thickets enough or new hardwood growth. Is that what they need, or do they need big old hard? I mean, what do they need?
Yeah, it's a little more rough. I mean, you know, our modern day quail hunting areas, you know, they're real pretty and meticulously maintained at a lower height than a lot of your grouse habitat. So you want, a lot of roughness and you know, chest high and those thickets. I mean, it's a lot rougher in grouse habitat.
Now, of course, it's spelled RUFFED, rough grouse, but we should be OUGHED, rough grouse.
Yeah, a little more there.
So, and we'll get to turkeys here, of course. Mike and I are loving to talk turkeys with you, but first, quail. And kind of, you know, it's been, 30-year decline, 40-year decline in quail populations all over the Southeast. Alabama is not immune from that. Has anything changed in that?
No, we keep plugging away, you know, far from, what the state can do. But it's just those ongoing changes, or most of them's already happened, but that landscape level change, you know, everything used to be patchwork and small farms and, all that's changed through the year. So our quail habitat's not there unless it's private properties that have the resource to really intensively manage for wild quail.
But y'all have at the state done some of this, though. It's not completely given up, because I know, like you and I talked last time about what happened at Conecuh and all that, and I saw a thing the other day, Blue Springs WMA there, a burn going on. So, I mean, y'all are doing some control burns, right, with the state?
Yeah. Yes, we are. Pretty much every one of our wildlife management areas has some prescribed fire going on, or at least a program on those areas. And it's not all tailored to quail, but quail, you know, definitely benefit. That they're called the firebird for a reason. So we have some areas that are, you know, we have areas within the area that we give a little more management effort to for small game, and especially bobwhite quail. So yeah. We are still plugging away at it. And, you know, most of our areas have a population of wild birds. They're not, it's not a real dense population, so, you know, kind of hard to hunt, or at least don't expect a lot of shooting. You might find a covey in a day, or some areas you might find three or four coveys in a day.
But hey, from private land, I'd take three or four coveys in a day. That's that's a good, it'd be a great day out there. Okay, but you said, you know, the management, different fire regimes. But and correct me, because I don't know if this is right, but I'll hear this, and it's kind of a thing I keep in the back of my head, that whatever management you would do for bobwhite, even if you're not a quail hunter, if you went down the bobwhite quail management route and managing that, you end up benefiting turkeys and deer. Is that true, not true, half true? What do you see?
That is true. You know, you get, there's a lot of different aspects of fire, but we probably don't have time to go down all those roads as far as scale, timing, and intensity and all those things. But, yes, most prescribed fire, you know, the result is a benefit to wildlife in general.
Do you keep up with other states, or other states having a problem with quail? I know I deer hunt out in Kansas, and the landowner is a big quail hunter, and he can go all day now and not see a covey of quail. When used to, he tells me that there's used to be just, you know, maybe on one piece of property might be 6 or 8 or 10 coveys of quail, but he says now he can go all day and not even see a covey of quail. Is it, so is Alabama or is other states like Alabama just don't have the population it used to have?
I can't speak to some of those western or midwestern states, but you know, that a lot of times it's a little different dynamic than the southeast. You know, some of those western states, Texas, Oklahoma, if they have a good rainfall, you know, they get a good hatch and have a good quail population the following season. So, you know, they're a little more rain dependent than this, you know, what we are. But yeah, I mean, quail, region wide, they've been in trouble, and but those states out there can bounce back a lot faster than us.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a crazy thing out there. Like, I watch Kansas and Oklahoma, you know, for trying to set up trips to go out there, and seeing what you're saying, that's it is. I mean, they'll have, like, I mean, it'll, I don't even know, triple, quadruple, quintuple population, yeah, year to year, just depending on weather.
Right. They're very, you know, quail are very prolific breeders. They can, you know, nest up to 3 times in one breeding season. And so, you know, they can bounce back pretty quick, but they just got to have the right habitat. And out there, you know, rainfall is key, because if they get into a 2-year drought, us people that go west to hunt, you might as well stay home until they have a good rain.
Right, but the flip side for us is kind of, in a way, rain without the rain we get here is the reason we lose quail habitat if we don't do something, right? It's that same rain that they need out there in the west to bring back, you know, get quail numbers up. It's kind of our rain that gets the habitat to grow up too much around here.
There's some places, soil types in Alabama that, yes, your cover can grow too good and be too rank, and that density, usually at the ground level of your cover, it counts a lot.
Yeah. So doing that, I mean, so what you're doing on state lands, of course, with the burns you're doing, benefiting a lot of different critters. What do you, when you consult with private landowners who want to, you know, whether they want to hunt them or just want to bring them back or want to, what are you telling them? I mean, is it just burn, burn, burn? What else are you telling them to do to try to get quail back on their private properties?
No, well, a lot of it depends on size of the property. You know, the larger the acreage, the better you can control a local population. So, you know, if we go to an area or a property, first thing we're going to do is look at the woods that are there, the timber, forested areas. If you've got a closed canopy, that's one thing. You need sunlight to the ground. So we're going to prescribe that you do a timber thinning, get that sunlight to the ground. Back to the burning, a lot of people depend just on prescribed fire as brooding habitat. You know, most places, quail nesting habitat is not lacking. What we see is a lack of brooding habitat. So quail nest, as soon as they hatch, they need a place to take those chicks. So those, you know, first 2 weeks of life, those chicks are fully dependent on insects. And so they need an area that's protecting them overhead, vegetation that's protecting them overhead, plus attracting a lot of insects. And it needs to be open at ground level so those chicks can move through there unimpeded while they're foraging, and so they can escape quickly from any predator that's after them.
Yeah, that overhead cover. I went, and obviously that talking about quail, but turkey fall into that mix quite readily. When we come back from the break, more with Stephen and Brandon, we'll talk about habitat. We're talking about where the population is too, looking at turkeys going into this season and any of the changes out there. But you want more turkeys, you got to have more turkey habitat to raise poults. So we'll do that when we return. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have you all along. Yeah, last day of deer season, so I figure that's kind of wrapped up and we're looking forward. But speaking of things coming up, too, at the end of this month, starting the 23rd, the Mobile Boat Show. Looking forward to that. Absolutely. We're back, as always, at the Mobile Boat Show Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. On Saturday, we do this show live from location at the boat show, a special two-hour that'll run from 10 to noon at the Mobile Boat Show. Plus all our guides from the Guides Corner there. A lot of fun, and it's always a good time to see y'all when you come
out.
And I got a special giveaway things that are coming. I'll tell you off air, Mike. They're pretty darn cool.
Okay.
We did floating keychains before. This is way bigger. Way bigger.
Huh.
Way bigger.
If it's bigger than a floating keychain,
yeah, now
it's
got
to be something.
Yeah, it's something. I'm going to tell you about it. All right.
Is it a Stanley Cup or something?
It is not a you and the dang Stanley Cups. By the way, Upland Bird Coordinator for the State of Alabama, Brandon Earls, and Supervising District Biologist Stephen Mitchell on with us. Do y'all have to deal with the Stanley Cup stuff like I do with Mike? I don't. It's just a dang cup. My gosh.
No, we stay away from that.
The Stanley Cup stuff. There.
Listen, don't knock it till you try it. I was the same way till I got one. I stole it from my wife when she got it for Christmas. She didn't like it.
So I
ain't say she didn't like
it. It's white, this one, but I'm going to get him a pink one. Yeah.
She didn't think she'd use it, so I started using it. And let me tell you, I haven't put it out of my hands since I got it. They're awesome.
Y'all, you see what I got to deal with? It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's ridiculous what
it's
I have.
It's not pink, so we're good.
I'm going to get you a pink one for Valentine's Day. You're going to love it.
I still use it.
It's going to be good stuff. All right. You know, when we're talking about quail, and, you know, it's something that's of interest to me, but, you know, there's not tons of people in Alabama that are worrying about the quail as much. But what you were talking about, Stephen, that is kind of, the way I understand it, that's the formula for having more turkeys.
Yes, it is. We see the same thing whenever a landowner's objective is turkeys. There's a lack of brood rearing habitat. So, you know, if it all looks great, hardwoods everywhere, you know, we see a lot of good looking turkey habitat or good looking turkey land for hunting turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
But for growing, you know, producing turkeys, you know, it's lacking. So those chicks, or those poults, chicks with quail or poults with turkeys, they have to be able to get past that first 2 weeks and on up to be recruited into the next adult population. So if you don't have the habitat out there, then you're really not helping the resource that you're taking from. So, we see a lack of that brood cover. You know, those weedy areas, those ugly-looking areas that most people don't want, that's what quail chicks and turkey poults need to survive.
But you say, okay, you say weedy areas. This is why I want to dig into this. And people can Google and look at what this looks like out there. Because people say, man, we got weedy areas. I got that all that thick grass over there, right? And they're, they're talking about nesting habitat. When you say weedy area, kind of explain more what that really looks like to you know, compared to, because people hear weedy area and they just think of the thick grass. I mean, you could even say like a Kogan grass. Yeah, that's all weedy in there. Look at all that. But what are you talking about? What's brood habitat versus nesting?
The nesting is, you know, mostly the dead looking grasses and leafy areas and shrubs that you see. That's more nesting. And turkeys, you know, they can nest. And they nest in odd places. They nest in open places. It just looks terrible. But they're depending on more their feather camouflage to hide them. And, you know, quail, you know, clump grasses, broom sedge, any clump grasses, they like to nest in that stuff. So, and you know how broom sedge looks in the fall and early spring. You know, it's just brown and dead looking. And they get in there and they have a nest. So brood, the weedy areas we're talking about for brooding, you know, it's the green growth, the succulent looking stuff that comes up in the spring. You know, a lot of places, quail places, they actually install brood habitat basically. Well, it serves two purposes on quail areas now. They install fields, basically a field, and it gets disc up in the fall, and then it's let fallowed, and in the springtime, you know, most times quail, you want a ragweed field to grow up, you know, everything that makes us itch and sneeze.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that comes up green and it's attracting bugs and it's producing that overhead cover. And the key to all brooding areas is being open at the ground level. Brood habitat, you do not want it too dense because those quail chicks or those turkey poults just can't go through it. And that's where the fire comes in on some areas. You know, you can produce it, brood habitat, with a disc in the ground, or a lot of people, like I said, depend on the prescribed fire. And then after that prescribed fire, you know, especially if you thin, if it's in timber and it's been thin, the sunlight's getting to the ground, well, that growth in springtime, you know, it's just weedy, succulent, and it's growing up and producing that cover to protect them from predators, plus it's attracting insects.
You want to see dirt. I mean, that's what I've always liked. You want to see dirt under your weeds. You want to see not all turf. You want to be able to see dirt some way that a little poult or a chick could be walking, right?
You know, quail are not good scratchers, so they really need the bare dirt under the vegetation. You know, turkeys get to a certain size, they can scratch a lot better than a quail. You want the bare ground either way.
Do you think that that's our pinch point? Like, as we look at turkey, and I'm going to get into kind of what we're looking at for turkey populations in the state, where we were last year, what we're looking at for this year. But where's the bottleneck? You just said you're on a lot of places have great turkey hunting habitat, you see, okay, and then places that have nesting habitat. Is that the thing that's keeping us from recruiting? Is the brooding habitat, is that the weak link?
Habitat in general, and especially the brood habitat, it's going to be in the combination that we're still trying to figure out. We haven't found all the answers yet to turkey populations, but it's going to be in the mix there. And, you know, that's what we see from a property-by-property evaluation. That habitat, that brood habitat, is just not there. So we're trying to get as much of that back on the ground as possible. And it needs to be a mixture. You know, you don't turn your whole, if you got 500 acres, you don't turn the whole thing the whole thing turned into brood habitat.
Right.
You know, having that diversity on a property is key. And, the brood habitat next to the nesting habitat, next to, the creek bottom oak patches or, upland oak patches. So, you want a mix of it all through the property.
Yeah, that's the
habitat.
And that's the hard thing, because you mentioned this with prescribed fire. And I want to get into this and talk about, incentives out there. We'll come back to turkey populations, but it gives me a second. Because it is easier to burn bigger blocks. Okay, you got everybody there. I'm a guy who burns a good bit, and you know it's easier to just say, well, we're going to set this 220 on fire. You know, we're going to set this 150 on fire because we can pull one big fire break around it, and you know we got a creek or whatever on one side. Versus going, you know, and then I don't know. I mean, the darn burn days we get. I mean, if you're a weekend warrior like me, you don't get tons of them. So you're like, well, heck, it's we got a good day, everything's right. Let's go ahead and set it on fire. But what y'all have shown in research is you want us burning a lot smaller patches. Is there money out there to fire breaks and all that kind of stuff? I'd love to have a checkerboard. It's just I can't afford to do it.
Yeah, there's different programs and even different NGOs that provide some funding, but the main one would be the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, or to boil that down, NRCS programs. And they have a program, EQIP, and there's another one. What's the other one? Brandon Conservation Reserve.
But you've got
ERP, that's the one you're trying to?
Yes. They have different programs that that can provide assistance, cost share assistance for, you know, things like prescribed burning, and I believe it even covers some fire breaks and installation.
But is there, and everything, I know, talking to biologists, everything is relative. I know it just depends what y'all say, but is there, if you had to, I don't know, we got to deal with the size of the property. The property's 1,000 acres, okay? What percentage of that, if possible, do you have in brooding habitat, nesting habitat, you know, old nesting habitat? I mean, is there I know it's going to be different, but I mean, is there some general rule of thumb that what your ratios would be?
The old adage would be 30-30-30.
Okay.
You know, 30% in brood, 30% in nesting, and, you know, the other 30 to me is just aesthetics, you know. So,
right.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, if we could, if most properties, if they can get, you know, 10 to 15% of the properties, a quail property anyway, in brooding habitat, that's great.
You know,
that's those fields. And like I said, you know, earlier with the installation of the fallow fields, it serves two purposes. So one, you know, during spring and summer, you know, that brooding cover is there. So, and, you know, with the aspect of hunting, you know, right before hunting season, a lot of those places, they'll take a disc and they're knocking those fields down. So it's moving those birds, you know, it's reducing the area that you got to hunt so they can mm-hmm. find those birds better during the season.
You know, one of the problems that we have in Alabama in trying to get this done is just take me, for instance. I mean, I'm hunting a piece of property that I don't own, you know, so they clear cut about 180 acres of 350 acres of it about 10 years ago. And it was good for, you know, turkeys and quail and everything earlier, but now it's not, you know, it's just gotten real thick and heavy cover. But I have no control over it. There's nothing I can do with it. Yeah. I can't do control burns. I don't own it. So I'm just limited.
Right. And you know, we see that with a lot of hunters. You know, a lot of hunters have to lease land, and, you know, your hands get tied there.
That's right.
If it's timber, you know, industrial forest, you know, you're leasing that. And all you can do basically is hunt it and, you know, plant food plots on the log landings.
But there's some value to, as we're talking about, this year, for a couple of reasons, but one for habitat, I left about a third of my patches go unplanted because they grew up without, you know, I thought pretty good brood habitat. They'd been, you know, they had that overhead cover and dirt on the bottom. But is there a value to that? I mean, you know, if you just left it go, you know, left a certain number of your patches go or something, will they be using that for brooding? I mean, it's the same kind of thing as it's strip disking.
Yes, it's just like, you know, what you're talking about. I mean, you know, we see that a lot. And in those industrial timber lands, you know, they clear cut an area and, you know, it gets site prepped and replanted fairly quickly. But those from the cutting in those first few years, it provides a lot of that, even nesting cover, but it provides a lot of that brooding cover. But then, you know, what happens after a while, those trees get up, the canopy out, and all the good stuff gets shaded out, so they have to go find somewhere else.
Yeah, well said.
And, you know, on your property, if you leave those areas out, yes, we recommend that. We do that on some of our management areas. You know, we call them early successional management areas. So they don't get replanted once it's cut. And, you know, it's allowed to grow for a couple of years. And then we set it back through fire and sometimes even mechanical means that, you know, those trees get up too high. Then it's not, you know, if things start canopying out, you know, it's reducing the actual cover and the habitat that you're after.
But there's a value to just, you know, if somebody has a lease and they were trying to do things to get their turkey populations up, and they got, I don't know, you got 15 fields on the place. For me, it wasn't a too big of an argument when I said, hey, y'all, we're not going to have to pay as much to plant this year. Because that's a good idea. But, I mean, just to leave three of them, you might not, you know, plant that year. Does that have value in just that year? I mean, it's not a multi-year. Probably in, you know, odd years you leave it, even years you plant it. I mean, is there any value to that?
Oh, yeah, there's value to that. Some of the weeds were, you know, it was discussing weeds. Some of those weeds, like ragweed, it has a pretty high protein value to it. So, yeah, you know, deer are going to browse on it. So, yes, it's between browse for deer and other animals, and, you know, it's providing that plus the brooding areas for your ground nesting birds. So, yes. Right. Rotating your food plots like that is very significant.
We're going to go to the break, but you mentioned something, and I like to reiterate this. I've seen it. Protein content on ragweed and partridge pea are in the neighborhood of soybean, right?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and I never knew that till
native grasses.
To you
yeah,
about
yeah.
It.
Yeah. Coming right back, more of our conversation. We'll get into the turkey numbers. Looking forward to this season and talk about what you can do to try to get more turkeys on the ground right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have y'all along. And great to have this conversation. Yeah, and are we a little bit ahead of the curve? Will we talk more turkeys between now and the 25th, I think, off the top of my head? I think that's when it starts. Yeah, for sure. But we're talking about the overall picture going into this turkey season as well. And doing that with Stephen and Brandon with the state of Alabama. Y'all, we're talking about how to get more turkeys, but what are we looking at now? Could y'all have any data from last year, how we did in 2023? I know that the harvest numbers were up, but did that necessarily mean we had more turkeys? What do y'all know about that?
It doesn't necessarily mean we have more turkeys. What we've seen, you know, since the COVID year, we saw a real increase in the number of hunters in Alabama. And I think, you know, those numbers have held up. You know, I think people reconnected, had time to reconnect with all the shutdowns and stay-at-home orders back during 2020 now, COVID year. So it has gone on. Those people reconnected with the outdoors or fell in love with it as a first-time hunter, and, you know, our hunter numbers have stayed the same. And it's, you know, I think it's just more hunters taking more turkeys, so.
And pretty significant, too. I mean, some seasons are better than others, weather-wise and how things work. But if I had the numbers right from what was published this last year, hunters reported taking 18,122 birds during the 2023 season compared to 15,673 during 2022 and 14,947 during 2021. I'm no math magician, y'all, but that's a strong increase in numbers taken.
It's very, very strong increase. And, you know, our postseason harvest estimates for last season was, you know, a little over 47,000 gobblers taken in the state. But the bad thing we're seeing is gang check compliance. You know, we're still estimating our compliance rate for, you know, folks reporting their harvest through the gang check system, but, you know, averaging around 42%, I believe. So that number needs to come on up so we can get a you know, a little more accurate data. You know, and it's, you know, doesn't hurt at all to game check that turkey.
Oh, absolutely.
We need folks to do that.
Well, and people need to do, you know, we've preached on here, I know y'all do, and we preach on the show about doing it. We need the data for research, but it's tougher. Those deer guys got it easy because they got the pinch point of people wanting to get their deer processed. That's that.
Right. Yeah.
If we could only figure out some kind of pinch point like that for turkeys, but I don't know that it's there. I don't know that anybody's going to take a turkey breast and legs anywhere to get processed. I'd take them to the crock pot, but, you know, I don't know how we change that.
Well, I don't know either. I guess, you know, if our perceived decline of turkey population continues, maybe folks will start helping out and doing everything that they can to help the turkeys. And, you know, reporting harvest is one of those things that can help.
And explain that, too. If somebody's riding down the road and says, what do you mean? Why is it, you know, why does that make it? Why is me reporting make it a hill of beans on this? Why does it make a difference? Y'all are just going to use that against me.
Well, first of all, we're not using any of our data against anyone. You know, there's been a perceived decline for several years now. Our, you know, we do surveys, brood surveys during the summer across the state, and those have been well below 2 poults per hen. You know, what we're looking at, it's just an observational survey. We're looking everywhere. If we see turkeys, we're counting the number of hens, the number of poults, and, you know, anything else, number of gobblers. So we're taking all that data. And then across the state, you know, we're averaging everything out and even down to the districts and the ecoregions. And what we've seen is that number of poults per hen has been below 2 for a decade now. And researchers consider 2 poults per hen the threshold for population sustainability.
And that's breaking so even, right? To put it in Sullivanese, 2 yeah. poults per hen is breaking even, keeping it where it is.
Yes. Yes, that's those turkeys that you see, they're replacing themselves at 2 poults per hen.
Okay. We're not there.
And we're not there, and it's very concerning, and, you know, hopefully, you know, the next hatch will be better, and we'll have a better average of what we're seeing. But so far, we don't have positive news. So any data, especially the game check harvest and harvest stuff, you know, if people will report, it gives us a better idea, and, you know, we can manage the resource better. Plus, if you're taking from the resource, you should be doing everything you can to help it. You know, a lot of times we see, we don't want this, we don't want that, y'all are against us, but we're not. We're just trying to manage the resource for you because, you know, we are the agency charged with protecting and conserving that resource, so we're just trying to do our jobs.
You know, and I think a lot of that's not intentional that people don't do it. I know me personally, I've killed a deer or a turkey and think about it the next day and say, oh, God, I didn't even report that, and report it then, you know? But I've been guilty of that. But at least when I think about it, I do report it. But I believe that's probably one of the issues in not getting as many people doing it. They just forget. It's been so many years that you haven't had to do it. And I think I know it is with me. I've been doing this a long time, and I forget sometimes. You know, you're excited. You've killed a deer, killed a turkey, whatever it is, and you just forget about it.
But and you know, we've got, if you think about it the next day, that's great too, because, you know, we'll take it whenever you can do it. If you forget about it one day, hopefully you won't. So, you know, most time when a regulation changes, there's a grace period,
right?
So this has been in place since 2017.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So everybody should be you know, kind of getting used to it now and remembering that.
You know, flip it around and put pressure on yourself, Mike, is the night before you get going turkey hunt, go ahead and game check that turkey.
Yeah, that's what
and
I
then
need
you
to
know
do.
You got you got to kill
what
it.
I need to do. Yeah, I get my limit quicker that way.
So talking about this bottleneck in population, here we are. What we hadn't talked, well, you mentioned them, but we're talking about hens, we're talking about poults, we're talking about brooding habitat, nesting, all that. We hadn't talked about gobblers in this very much, And but the regulations, obviously, the thing y'all can work with is how many gobblers, right? I mean, we're mentioning gobblers. How many gobblers taken? Reporting gobblers, but how important are gobblers once they're done doing their thing to the entire population of turkeys?
Well, it's important to, you know, carry over, but, you know, that's what the research has shown. You know, we need those gobblers there to breed those hens to get that reproduction. And later in the season, after they've served their biological purpose, they're not as important as they were to start the season.
So this is that change of the dates, right? This idea that, you know, a lot of people, I mean, we've talked about it several times. You and I have talked about it, Mike, and we've had Chuck Sykes on talking about it. But people may not have heard that there was a chance that there were hens not getting bred. I mean, the first time I heard that, I was kind of slack-jawed. You know, years ago, I said, wow, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yes. Well, when you consider that annually in Alabama, you know, we take out around 50% or a little over of our entire harvest. It occurs during that first 2 weeks, week and a half of the season. So, you know, when it was opening on March the 15th, same deal. We were taking out just as many then. So if you're taking out, you know, if your total harvest, if 50% of it's coming from the first week or two of the season, that's a lot of gobblers hitting the ground.
And I guess
they're not there to breed those hens.
Right, but people had this, but I mean, just to play, and I know you got an answer for it, but they'll say, well, there are other gobblers in there, and they'll take that opportunity and breed those hens. That gobbler's gone. The old strutter's gone. But, you know, that those two-year-olds I saw, you know, they're going to get it done.
Right. You know, and that's been some controversy talking about all that. But if you look at it, just, you know, me with a different view, you know, we do know it's factual biologically that they have a hierarchy. So even right now, you know, there's some gobblers that have started up, and mm-hmm. and we get reports, oh, they're gobbling like crazy. They're going to be done before the season comes in. Well, no. That's part of that hierarchy. They're establishing dominance. So there's going to be that one dominant gobbler in the area. So he's done all the fighting. He's there. Testosterone's rising. Season opens, he gets taken out. That don't mean he's bred all those hens yet. So, yes, there's going to be another gobbler take his place. But after he got taken out, all that fussing and fighting is going to start again. So they got to go through that process one more time. And then he's the dominant gobbler. So it kind of pushes that breeding activity a little bit. And if that one gets killed, it might push it a little bit more. So, you know, you're just pushing and pushing till they're breeding late and, you know, nesting might start later. Now, this is a lot of speculation on my part.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that there's a hierarchy. And the earlier the hens get bred, the earlier they nest, the earlier they hatch. It's all higher success rates.
All right,
so if we're doing anything to push all that further away, the success rates are going down.
Coming right back, more of our conversation on turkeys, making more turkeys, with Stephen Mitchell and Brandon Earls right here on midday on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have y'all along. Last day of deer season. Hope you get it done this afternoon.
Well, I hope so too, Sean. One thing, I wish our guests were down here in the studio with us, because we could give them a sack full of blue moon pies and yellow moon pies.
The new blueberry moon pies are all the rage for Mardi Gras. Y'all got to figure that out. We'll do the outdoor show with y'all in studio next year during Mardi Gras. Come down, do some Mardi Gras fun, and then we'll talk turkeys. How about that?
Sounds good.
I think they'd rather just come down and go turkey hunting.
Now you're talking.
Nah, that's what I thought. Mardi Gras, nah, but turkey hunting, yeah, come on, you come down.
Yeah, let's see. We got 5 or 6 minutes left here. Let's talk about, because Mike and I bounced this around 10 times, about turkeys being gobbled out. And something that Mike and I have come up with so many times is that when you go, like you go on a Thursday, whatever, pick a day, you go on that day and it's just nothing. Nothing's going on, and you're like, they're
beautiful
done.
Day, yeah. Perfect day.
Everything looks perfect. Barometric pressure's right.
Nothing.
you know, you're like, they're done because the barometric pressure's right, everything's good. And I mean, I heard one bird fire off twice and one once, and then I didn't hear anything else. And so you say, ah, the heck with it. Your buddy goes Saturday. The weather's not even as good.
I go the next day.
Yeah, and they blowing the dang leaves off the trees. That's the thing I don't understand.
Simple explanation. Some days they just don't gobble.
That's what I figured out. I could be a biologist, couldn't I, Sean?
I think that's one of the dangers, you know, when you – I mean, I'm lucky to live on the land and can listen, but if you don't live on the land, you just go – and this formula, and I grew up thinking this. If it was good and still, you know, and had high pressure and all, you know, whatever, then they would gobble. If they didn't gobble, it was something, they were done gobbling. But if you stick with them, and y'all's research will show too, let alone just our regular research of just going and being in the woods, non-scientific, they some days they just don't gobble. And for whatever reason, we don't know yet.
That's correct. Well, we haven't seen, you know, north to south, we haven't seen any big variation, you know. Of course, early season, they're gobbling better, and it's going to wane towards the end of the season. But, you know, we really haven't seen any big differences north to south. That's not to say we've got research going on now. It's not ready yet, but so far there hasn't been a difference in those ARUs, you know, automatic our mm-hmm. autonomous recording units, and we've had those on different places in North Alabama and middle part in South Alabama. So, you know, from what I can say right now, it's not showing much of a difference in when they're gobbling and from north to south. I mean, it's all pretty much the same.
Yeah, if people don't know what you're talking about, y'all, it's like a audio version of a game camera, right? I mean, it's listening for right. gobbles.
Right.
And recording them.
Yeah.
No matter, you know, every day. That is cool. I read through that. Is that on Outdoor Alabama?
I don't think so. There might be an article alluding to it, but I don't think the results are posted yet.
It's pretty cool stuff, y'all. It's kind of showing you know, what we think we hear versus what really happened.
And what do you mean right. by that?
It listens. You know, like, you know what? I can stand there, and Mike, you're, I mean, too many years in radio for me and too much duck hunting and pit blinds and all that. I'll stand there and you can hear a turkey. Mike's, you know, my senior, he's older than I am, and he can hear a turkey that I can't hear.
Way older than you.
Yeah, way older than me, and he can hear it. And my friend I hunt with a bunch sometimes will hear a turkey I can't hear. That turkey still gobbled, I just didn't hear it. These ARUs he's talking about, they hear it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They check on before daylight until, you know, after gobbling time and at fly up time, and they start, I think it's early February or mid February, all through the season, and even a little time after the season that those things are recorded.
So it's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard them in January, like most deer hunters have, and I've, you know, definitely start hearing them pretty good in February, and then even in June, go back up there and
if you're in the woods, that's the thing. And I will stay in the woods. Yeah. Well, I live on the land, but people will say, "Well, they're not. Well, they weren't
not there.
They're not there.
That's
so
right.
You definitely not hear them.
Once
season's over and you're not there, and we just got a couple minutes. But you know, we started off talking about quail, and I do wonder about this. You know, back in 1960 or something, if you'd have told Alabama quail hunters or 1950 that, you know, they're in trouble, we got to do something, they probably wouldn't have wanted to listen then either. And that's what scares me. You know, the bleak situation is for quail. That could we be looking at something like that for turkey? We're not. It's not there. It's not tomorrow. It's not even in 5 years. Not 10 years. But are we being given a chance again to try to make sure something like that doesn't happen, like we have with quail? I don't know. I don't know if they're. I mean, they're not the same bird. But what do you think?
I think there's still time to reverse our population trajectory. There's still a lot of questions that, you know, through research that need to be answered as far as to some of the whys of a population decline. So hopefully we'll get those answered. But, you know, there's some stuff that people can do. I mean, or, you know, other things that we need to look at nowadays, you know, look at how far technology has come along. And we get something like COVID. And, you know, there's some people that have a traditional view of turkey hunting, and some people that are just learning now, whether it be young folks or somebody that never hunted, but all they know is, you know, decoys and a souped-up shotgun and choke and shells and, you know, shoot it at 80 yards, which is not traditional. So there's a lot of things that have changed that, that we might need to start taking a look at.
Yeah, that's a tough thing, too. I mean, are there gobblers died? Obviously, there's more people turkey hunting. But is the individual turkey hunter, new turkey hunter in the 1970s, or not, I was in the 1980s when I started, new turkey hunter in the 1980s, his efficiency rate versus a new turkey hunter in 2024?
I can tell you right now.
It's a lot higher.
Yeah, it's a lot higher. Back when I started in the 70s, there wasn't anybody. The only thing you had was Ben Roger Lee cassette tape that you could listen
right,
to.
That's right.
And I listened to it every morning and every night just about during turkey season, trying to, you know, get one little hint out of how to do it. Nobody tell
we're
me
dead,
how to
we're
do it.
We're deadlier turkey hunters now, even the new person, even the person who's not there.
Videos everywhere. I mean, you can go look it up on YouTube and watch 10 hours of it or 24 hours of it if you want to. Yeah.
Yep. That's definitely a lot more efficient hunters now.
Yes.
Better equipment, new technology, and you know, talking, I probably started hunting in late 70s myself or early 80s with my dad. I mean, you know, some of it I wasn't toting a gun, but I, you know, I remember those times too. And back to game check compliance. You know, it was hard to get anybody to say anything about
no. Uh-uh, buddy. They wouldn't tell you nothing.
My dad's friends would try to pick at me and get me to say something, you know, just picking. But my dad would say, you better not say a word.
That's right.
We
no.
Yeah, I had never even seen one. Never you heard one gobble. We don't know where you are.
Yeah,
so we got some, you know, we still got some of that same mindset here in the heart of turkey restoration and turkey hunting country, Alabama.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, we were secretive then, and so it's hard for some of us to think about game checking and, you know, what they going to do with this. And they going to know where I'm hunting. And no, we're not.
100%.
Yeah, you can tell game. Don't tell your brother-in-law, but tell game check for sure. Stephen, Brandon, we're running out of time, but let's do this again. I appreciate having y'all on.
Well, we thank you for having
us. Thank you.
All right, and yeah, more turkey hunting talk, of course, coming in the next month or so as we head towards March 25th.
And I'm going to eat that blueberry moon pie.
Okay, you have the moon pie, and then we'll do this show again next week. Have a good one.